Welcome to ACMN Conversations, a podcast about media, marketing, and entertainment. I'm Lyndall Pond, ACMN's Managing Director. As we celebrate International Theatre Day today, we're speaking with one of the industry's most well-known people because theatre has been in his family for many, many years. So who better to help us acknowledge the day than Jason Mariner of Mariner Theatres? Welcome, Jason. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, Lyndall. Thank you for the invitation.
Good to have you here. Mariner Theatres is synonymous with Melbourne's cultural scene. We talk about being the cultural capital of Australia. And I know I am a little biased as a Melbourne girl, but I think the fact that we have all our gorgeous theatres in the CBD, in the middle of the beating heart of our theatre, it's just so fabulous. And the Mariner family have been proprietors and custodians of the Melbourne Heritage Theatres for over 30 years. So we're going to take some time today to get to know a little bit more about you and about the theatres as well. So let's start at the beginning. How did it all start? How did your family get involved with all these gorgeous theatres in Melbourne?
Goodness. Well, 1986 it was, and when Dad purchased the Princess Theatre. And, you know, prior to that, Mum and Dad had only seen one production of Hair. They went on a date, I think, was the story, and had seen Hair. So not a lot of theatre experience at all, you might say.
Wow.
But Mum and Dad, and we grew up in Colac, and Dad's parents and grandparents were from Colac, and and at the time in 1986 we were also living in Colac, which is a regional town, an hour and a half, 2 hours out of Melbourne. An enormous step to go from Colac to proprietor of the Princess Theatre.
That's amazing. I didn't know that.
Yeah, I know. And the introduction, our dad was running with his brother and father, ran Budget Furnishings in Colac, and which was a successful regional furniture store, which was part of a sort of a collective of stores throughout regional Victoria. And that was successful, but Dad by nature is entrepreneurial. And he'd started to do some more property type development and other things. But one of the things that he did, which was incredibly contrarian, was in Colac on Murray Street was a derelict courthouse, which is probably was an old bluestone courthouse that it'd probably been there for 100 years, but certainly for my living time had been a derelict building. But he renovated it and turned it into the Colac Courthouse Restaurant. And again, one of those strange, and I can remember it. I actually remember the renovation because I remember us as kids finding, you know, the penny coins under the floorboards, and it was like excavating an old treasure trove. But it reopened, and when it reopened, Don Dunstan, whom was the Premier of South Australia, came and opened the restaurant. And again, what a lot of people appreciate Don Dunstan's enormous artistic legacy, particularly in South Australia, but ultimately Australia, that he was a celebrity chef. And I'm assuming this was before he was Premier. But he definitely came and stayed with us in Colac, and he opened the restaurant with that. And so we had the Colac Courthouse Restaurant. And it was at a time when anything old was really completely out of fashion. It was the period of modernism where the ornamental was frowned upon, and modernism was really an architectural movement, which was symbolic, I guess, of the times too, where like hard-edged function over form. And and, you know, which then led into the brutalist movement where, you know, those buildings with just no aesthetic whatsoever, were, like the Barbican in London being one of the more famous examples, and the Harold Holt swimming pool here in Melbourne. So the point being, it was a completely against the grain to take an old building that was completely out of favour and to turn it into a restaurant, which now wouldn't be that unusual, but then it was very unusual. And anyway, it inspired the building, I guess, to link the Don Dunstan story to Adelaide Festival Centre, as you'd know, was a real hot melting point for Australian performing arts, and it was a little before my time. But 1970s was obviously a really, really creative point, and perhaps the beginning of Australian creativity in many ways. And the Adelaide Festival and the Adelaide Festival Centre seemed to be where the centre of the Australian performing arts and arts scene what was. And Victoria, by default, was seen to be somewhat moribund and old Victorian by nature, and that was reflected in the architecture. And it was Dick Hamer whom, to reinvigorate the Victorian arts scene, decided that we essentially needed to have what Adelaide had, and that was a new modern festival centre, or Centre for the Performing Arts. So that was the art centre was imagined, and it ultimately opened in 1984. And in 1984, with the art centre opening, the ballet, the opera moved, and the musicals and so on and so forth moved to the art centre, and essentially then the older theatres fell into or became derelict.
Yeah.
So the Carroll family had owned the Princess Theatre for two generations, and it essentially closed in, I think it was, well, in 1983 they had 36 weeks of occupancy, and in 1984 they had 5 days, and two of which were the Scout Gang Show. And the theatre reopened. So they went essentially broke, and the theatre was put on the market. And it was on the market for some period of time, but a real estate agent cottoned on that maybe this guy from Colac who'd shown an interest in old buildings might be interested. And a mum took the call at home and from the agent. And initially, I don't think she knew what he was talking about. But anyway, Dad had a look at the theatre when he was in Melbourne and saw, you know, the potential, because obviously it was a beautiful building. And took an option, and Birch purchased the Princess Theatre for a dollar, as the story goes. Optioned the purchase of the Princess Theatre for $1 in 1986. And that's a bit of a long story, but that's how it came to, you know, from Colac to Spring Street.
Spring Street, yeah. Oh, I love it. It's amazing. And so you actually just alluded then to the theatres becoming a bit derelict when the Art Centre, or whatever the Art Centre looked like in those days, was built. And I always associate with your family with the family that saved the Melbourne theatres. So is that where the knock-on to the other venues that you own came about?
Yes. So 1986 purchased the theatre, and then the management that were there was not much of a management, mind you, you know, I think Dad said, you know, if you haven't got something, if you're not doing something within a certain period of time, then you can leave. And the only show running at the time, I think, was the Rocky Horror Show, which is at the Universal Theatre. And anyway, they struck a deal to bring Rocky Horror into the Princess, and it was an enormous success. You know, the old theatre, it's hard to imagine, but the old theatre was painted a dark green colour, the exterior, so it was quite old, decrepit. There was a velvet flock wallpaper on the walls in it kind of looked nothing like it. It was very, very run down. And but Rocky Horror was the perfect show. And I remember, Dad, it actually made quite a lot of money in that initial season, which I think surprised Dad that it could actually make money. And and when he used to come, the other, you know, serendipity was when he used to come to Melbourne, would stay at what was is the Marriott now on Lonsdale and Exhibition Street, but was then Rockman's Regency. And they used to advertise who was in town on the board, who were the guests in house. And Cameron McIntosh was in Melbourne because he was there for Cats, which was about to start at Her Majesty's. And Dad organised a meeting through, I think, the concierge or the reception desk with Cameron while he was in town. Oh, wow. And obviously the other thing that was happening at the time was that Cameron and Cameron McIntosh and Andrew Lloyd Webber creative partnership was really the beginning of the revival or the creation of the modern musical. And Dad took Cameron through the Princess and essentially struck a deal that if the theatre were renovated, that his productions, which were just opening in the West End of Les Mis and Phantom of the Opera, would reopen the Princess Theatre. So a deal was done and sort of was set about renovating the theatre in a very difficult period, industrial period, which caused a lot of heartache. And what was originally a $12.5 million restoration of the theatre ended up being closer to $27 million. So, yeah, almost a, you know, 2.5-time budget blowout, which would derail most, but if, you know, into finance was obtained, and part reason is because the pre-sale for Les Mis and Phantom had been so incredibly strong, and subsequently, the market, I might remember 1989, the bottom fell out of the Victorian market, the Australian market. That was the recession. Mm-hmm. The beginning of the recession, and the theatre reopened with Les Mis in December of 1989. And then in a very, very, very difficult time in Victoria's history, the Princess Theatre was sold out for 2.5 years, which really became a beacon of prosperity in a time when, you know, everything else was doing it really tough.
Yeah, yeah. Theatre definitely comes to the fore when there's challenges in people's life because of it's such escapism, isn't it?
And I think particularly when theatre became a real draw card, like Les Mis. I remember Les Mis for me was the first major musical production I'd ever seen, and you just remember the barricade and the way that sort of continually evolved, and it was incredibly dramatic. And you know, Les Mis, and then to be followed by Phantom, which again were just absolutely must-sees. It just really was the beginning of an incredible period for musical theatre. It's fair to say, reinventing the musical.
It was the event status of it, wasn't it? That it was, you know, it was just a major cultural event. You just had to be seen at an event, as much as they were brilliant shows as well. It was about the experience.
Everybody had to go and see it, yeah, and so many from New Zealand. So at the time, well, John Cain was the Labor Premier, but with the economic malaise, he was always going to be voted out. There was a change of leadership. Joan Kerner became Premier of Victoria for a short period of time, and you know, off the back of the success of Les Mis and Phantom at the Princess Theatre and that event success, she started what was Melbourne Major Events. And then Jeff Kennett, when he became Premier, continued that, acquiring other major events. And ultimately, you know, 30 years later, Victoria's created from really nothing. And I'd like to think, you know, musical theatre and the Princess were a part of that. Was the catalyst for the creation of what is a pre-COVID, a $34 billion economic, which from Victoria, which was a manufacturing Rust Belt economy at the time, to being a having the highest interstate visitation of any other capital city in Australia is hard to fathom. But you know, we've really collectively, as in Melbourne, created a really desirable event city. Something always going on.
Yeah, totally. And so, I mean, now particularly, but even back there, I'm sure it was too, so well supported by the rest of what happens in the CBD. Great bars, great restaurant. Need I mention the coffee? You know, that whole experience of coming to a cosmopolitan capital city. It was the thing that started it all.
I think we went 360 degrees from, you know, modernist, brutalist period, which was really Adelaide's period of flourishing. What happened was that there was a real revaluing, and I think we identified that actually what set Melbourne apart, and you related to it in your introduction, was that the theatres were part of the city's DNA. They're part of the CBD grid. The Regent Theatre is right smack bang in the middle of Melbourne. The Princess Theatre on Spring Street is opposite Parliament House. The Comedy Theatre is on Exhibition Street. Her Majesty's, the Athenaeum on Collins Street. Melbourne has these theatres that are on arguably priceless land within the city, but allocated to theatres. And part of the reason is because they've been there for, you know, in the cases of the Princess, 150 years.
Yeah.
And so we've got this, we've got theatres that are a part of the CBD, and they sit adjacent to great food, great coffee, great hotels, and great retail experiences. So the sum total and the laneways. So no other city in Australia has the, I mean, I love Sydney, but for different reasons that, you know, I love Melbourne. And I think that's, you know, you have to embrace what your own advantages are. And I think the heritage and the, and the uniqueness of the heritage theatres that we have in Melbourne set us apart. And ultimately, in the intervening 30 years, I think they've been revalued and appreciated as being very, very, you can't imagine pulling the Princess Theatre down now.
No, I was just thinking as you were talking then, I mean, they must all be completely protected now, thank goodness, because obviously that is what's gone awry in other cities where the beautiful old theatres weren't protected, and so they were sort of demolished overnight, whereas, you know, ours have got such value now in Melbourne that they will always be there. They will always be protected.
Yeah, we would hope.
We would hope, exactly, yeah. This is an amazing history lesson of my city and my state, but I want to just quickly go back. So then how did you guys end up getting the other theatres that you have in the portfolio? Did it just sort of one success story rolled onto another?
I think so. I think, you know, the Princess Theatre was Field of Dreams. So, you know, build it and they'll come, and, you know, build it and they will come. We did with the Princess. It was quite extraordinary. I think 4,000 people a week travelled from New Zealand just to see Phantom. And it ended up playing for 2 years, but probably if it, they kept overrunning the dates because it was meant to go to the Royal in Sydney.
Yeah.
And I think it was originally scheduled for a year, but after a year of extensions and the Royal just being, they decided, no, they had to move it. So, and then, you know, I think next we had Beauty and the Beast come, which ran for 18 months and which was extraordinary too. But the opening of the Phantom of the Opera, the opening night party, when Cameron McIntosh and Andrew Lloyd Webber and Dad and I think it was Jeff Kennett at the time, it was at the Regent Theatre, and the Regent had been derelict in the centre of Melbourne for 26 years because originally it was Melbourne City Council had bought it with the intention of demolishing it and becoming a shopping centre. But then there were green bans put on the Regent site by the union, which was part political, maybe as much as it was to do with heritage conservation at the time, but yeah, ultimately
worked in the favour of the theatre, though.
Yeah, but so for 26 years, the building had sat derelict, and Melbourne's there. We had an old water wall on the city square, which would flood where the ballroom is now. So you can imagine for a Phantom and the Opera opening night party to have a an old derelict theatre with
perfect
cobwebs and old carpets and then a flooded basement. So you've got the
brand.
So it was literally from the enthusiasm for from the opening of Phantom of the Opera, and Andrew was working on Sunset Boulevard at the time. And so he, committed Sunset Boulevard if the Regent were restored, and the union movement, in conjunction with our family, invested in the restoration of the Regent, and the Melbourne City Council and state government bought 50% of the underlying building, and there was circa $50 million invested in 1996 to reopen the Regent Theatre primarily as a lyric theatre. And it opened and it reopened with Sunset Boulevard, which launched to the career of Hugh Jackman.
I was going to say, that one.
Yeah, well, it was actually
in... And Deborah Byrne, wasn't it? Deborah Byrne in that one?
Yeah, Deborah, obviously not launching Deborah's career, but Deborah Byrne, Hugh Jackman.
Celebrating
and,
it.
Yeah, and Hugh actually before... he was in Beauty and the Beast playing Gaston, of course. So.
That was the beginning of his career, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. So, again, it was an incredible season of Sunset Boulevard and an enormously expensive and lavish production. But it played for 9 months. And so the Regent was born. And in that same period of time, the Forum was acquired. It was... the Revivalist Church. It was used by a church group, and the comedy was acquired from Paul Dainty.
Because they used to have their offices upstairs, didn't they?
Yeah, and I think Paul had owned the theatre from the 1970s, so yeah. He had a long history there. And originally, the comedy was part of the J.C. Williamson theatrical empire. So.
Yeah.
Quite an extraordinary story, but part of the ability to add the Forum and was because one of the difficulties that became apparent with the Princess Theatre was that you have a as soon as the theatre goes dark, which invariably they did and do, then you had a whole management team and staff out of work for a period of time, which kind of made it unsustainable as a business and there'd be times when the theatres, just by way of programming or demand, would be dark. But having a kind of a critical mass of venues meant that there was always something to engage a management team, even or an operating business, if the theatres were dark. So bringing all the theatres together in 1996 was really then the beginning of Mariner Group and. All these years later, we've sort of, up until COVID, we were sort of going from strength to strength.
Yeah. And when did you personally get involved? I mean, obviously, as a kid, you were around it, but when did it become and how did it become your profession, I guess?
Yeah. By default, because I was, in the country, I was doing ag science at Melbourne Uni.
Of course you were.
But at the time, I was working in the, which I loved, working in the bar at the theatre. Actually started the first 6 months I worked as a cleaner and labourer because I was saving to go overseas and that was really great. And then when I was at uni, I worked in the bar for 5 years. And after I finished uni, I went to Japan for 9 months. And then when I came back, I started as a production coordinator on Showboat. And did that and then really started in the theatre in a full-time capacity in 1997. and as the programming coordinator.
Yeah, great. So it's kind of just always been in and around your life.
I think what I like, part of the reason I think I do it well is because performing and singing and dancing is not my talent. I was more sport and more, but I think what I do is then I have a profound appreciation of the skill. And I can often, I think, you know, I'm chief hand clapper. I'm really just there to appreciate the talents of others. And I have no desire. I just have an appreciation for the skill, the talent, the work and the effort involved in, you know, both performing in and presenting, you know, theatre. So I can just be a true fan and, you know, see, and I kind of learnt that when I was at uni. It was sort of a progression during those 5 years to I thought, well, actually here's something really fantastic, and actually I really, as we all do when we fall into it, realise, you know, it's kind of a blessing. It's a beautiful industry where we ultimately what we do is all good, nothing really bad about it at all, and we're really just, you know, expressing the best of humanity and, you know, and entertaining people. And I think also too, providing an expression for peak human performance. And, you know, we often, sometimes it can be derided by saying we're not saving lives, but I think we make lives because ultimately we reach for, you know, in the performing arts and arts generally, higher values.
It's such a glass half full way to describe it, isn't it? Because sometimes we do as an industry say, oh, well, we're not, you know, we're not on the front line, you know, we're not saving lives, but actually, yeah, we're enhancing people's lives and experiences, and in tough times, as you alluded to before, bringing a lot of joy to people and a lot of escapism. And I think I talk about this all the time on this podcast, but you have one show in your theatre right now that is the show for the post-COVID experience in Moulin Rouge, because people just, they just want some joy and they just want to escape, and it ticks every one of those boxes.
Yeah, it's, you know, as I tell the story, I always think it's, you know, you kind of think in some ways you can control destiny and you can, you know, you can work in a particular way to a particular outcome. But even as I tell that story, it's unfathomable as a, you know, 10-year-old or 15-year-old boy even, that this would have been the way that life would have panned out. And then, you know, whom could have ever imagined for the last 2 years we would have been, you know, just when we were all getting, and felt like we were all getting up to speed and things were going so well, that, you know, we would be shut for two. I mean, you just couldn't imagine a bigger catastrophe, really, could you? Other than a war.
Yeah, it just remains a little bit mind-boggling.
but then, almost mind-boggling, hard to imagine. Couldn't conceive of it beforehand. But it arrives, and we deal with it. But then I think, you know, when I'm looking to the glass half full, it's like, well, if you were to plan for 20 years to write a musical that would best respond and be most suitable to come back from a pandemic, you couldn't conceive of anything better than Moulin Rouge, could you? It's just, so, you know, to find a way to be grateful, Moulin Rouge is sold out. It's what ended up being a 5-month season, because it's been abbreviated somewhat by that, but 5 months to a sold out 12 weeks, essentially, or 10 weeks sold out before the end of the run, completely sold out, just shows, to your point, how much people really are loving that opportunity to come out and celebrate the best of life.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've alluded to a couple of great personalities that have come through the theatres, and, you know, I know ACMN's always sort of said, oh, there's a lot of legends that have gone through those through those Mariners theatres. I mean, we love to see Angela Lansbury and James Earl Jones at the Comedy, Topol at the Regent, and many others. And we've talked about a couple that have gone before us, but maybe who are some of your favourites, some of those big names that have come through your beautiful theatres?
Yeah, that's a good question. I I'll go to homegrown because we have had a lot of international, you know, people at various times come through. Jerry Seinfeld, that was one of those moments that you couldn't have had a hotter person on the planet when Jerry Seinfeld arrived in Australia, because he started his world tour here and he started it in Melbourne. And it was after he'd finished filming Seinfeld, but before the final episode had gone to air. Yeah, that was pretty extraordinary. And, but, you know, Todd McKinney, the boy from Oz, that was, I don't know, I just, that was an incredible high point too. I think because partly you think, you know, there can't be much cool about this. And then, you know, the way he brought that show to life, that was extraordinary. Deborah Byrne, you know, I thought she was extraordinarily memorable in Sunset Boulevard. Marina Pryor during Phantom. Maybe Lisa McCune is always a favourite because, you know, when we had Sound of Music just after she'd finished a run in Blue Heelers, I remember a conversation with Rodney saying, you know, I don't think we'll need more than 16 weeks. The show would have sold out for 52 weeks. It was that hot.
Yeah, she was really hot then, wasn't she? And so talented, yeah. Anyway.
Oh, the talent's there. She's still an extraordinary performer.
Yeah.
I don't know. There's just so many. I mean, Maggie McKenna right now, to be very, you know, in Jagged Little Pill.
Absolutely.
Nat Bassingthwaite, geez, she can perform. Sing, perform, Des and Alinta in Moulin Rouge. Really couldn't see a better cast anywhere in the world.
What about when sometimes, you know, you feel like a show is just made for a theatre? And I think we all felt like that when Wicked made its Australian premiere at the Regent. What are some of your kind of memories of those shows that you just thought, I've just got to have that show in that theatre, or some that have come and had a perfect
fit? Well, gee, again, just talking about that incredible gratitude and serendipity of the time, because I'll go reverse order, because Moulin Rouge is really made for the Regent Theatre. It's just perfect. And, you know, we've renovated the theatre. The balcony is now 5 metres closer to stage than it was. It's really optimised for, you know, both contemporary amenity and also to just a relationship to stage. So Moulin Rouge, I just think in the Regent Theatre is just perfect. But then I go back one more step and say, to see Come From Away in New York, and then think, you know, there is no better theatre for Come From Away than the comedy. Mm. It just hand in glove, wasn't it?
Yeah, agree. Yeah.
And then The one step before that was, you know, when everyone was clamouring to speak to Sonia Friedman the world over for this extraordinary play that everyone had heard about, and everyone, every producer and every theatre the world over was clamouring for, I thought the only way I can present, and I literally just had a beautiful picture of the Princess Theatre, exterior blown up, and I just went and said, I think I've got the perfect theatre for the show. And luckily she agreed, because the Princess Theatre fits Harry Potter in the most extraordinary of ways. And not only the way that it supports the magic, but, you know, you step into the Princess Theatre and you really are stepping into a magical, mystical world.
Yeah, and a different period of time. I mean, I've not seen that show in another theatre, but I could not imagine it anywhere else. It just worked so perfectly there. And as you say, the magic is so convincing, and yeah, it's fabulous.
Yeah. So, I mean, just there you go. One, like the most recent three shows, but I've often thought it's just been quite extra. I mean, to say, obviously, Moulin Rouge sold out in its 5 months in completely, and obviously would have sold three times that if we had that opportunity. But Come From Away, I think the highest selling show in the history of the Comedy Theatre before Come From Away was I See It on the Wall, Rock of Ages.
Now that's a good night at the theatre.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we sold 128,000 tickets from memory, which was extraordinary. That was a great run at the Comedy, but Come From Away ended up selling over 310,000 tickets. Which has just raised the bar incredibly and just speaks to how perfect that show was in that theatre at that time.
And for that city too, I think.
It's,
really fit beautifully. I'm also obviously really interested in what the next few years holds for us as an industry, you know, in terms of new work. It will be, I always sort of talk about the pipeline, you know, what's coming from Broadway and the West End when they too have been impacted. Did you have a view on that? And what do you think, what's in store for us for the next couple of years?
Yeah, well, clearly, I mean, the entire artistic world has been furloughed for a period of time. And, you know, out of that may spring some really incredible work in time. But that obviously will take time, and it'll take, you know, a return in confidence and audience confidences to sustain, you know, investments to develop new shows. So I don't know. I think you're right in as far as it's very difficult to see, you know, when we look at what we've got in Melbourne. Hamilton is about to open at Her Majesty's Theatre, which is record-breaking in its in its own way, and Harry Potter at the Princess and Moulin Rouge at the Regent, and just closing Jagged Little Pill at the Comedy. But it's just been an extraordinary slice. Could not have better productions at this moment in time, and it's hard to actually see. And in time, there'll be something that raises the bar again. It's always the case, but it's almost like the bar is so high at the moment.
I know, it's hard to see where it's going to get to, isn't it?
And I think that's what you call surely. And I'm, you know, as you know, we always have to be, and we always are rewarded by optimism, because it's easy to, you know, put a pessimistic shade, you know, that, well, that's, but it's hard not to believe at the moment we're at a peak and, you know, things have to cycle again and, you know, society will, you know, find its level. But I think what keeps proving true as we talk about World Theatre Day is that people, in spite of technology and sometimes in spite of technology, continue to value the experience of engaging with a artist and friends and family and colleagues in a really live sense. And hopefully that, at the core of humanity, hopefully that persists. And, you know, in 10 years' time we'll be talking about really exciting things happening, none of which we can possibly conceive of at the moment, but ultimately still at its roots being what theatre is about, and, you know, telling stories, operating, you know, performing, seeing incredible talent and being entertained.
Yeah, so there is obviously an exciting future, which sort of does lead me to my next question quite nicely. You're a pretty important figure in Melbourne, and you do, as we've talked about, represent a really important part of the fabric of the city. So now we're sort of emerging from the pandemic and the impact of it. What are some of your thoughts on the reinvigoration of Melbourne as a city, and obviously in light of the theatres or as well as the theatres?
Yeah, that's a big question. And I think, you know, again, this is something that Melbourne perhaps does a little bit differently to other cities, is that I think Victorians by nature are parochial, and we take a lot of pride in what we do here and the way we present ourselves. And I just pull it back to a individual and think, what can we personally do just to make people feel confident, welcomed, and you know, and frankly, you know, a desirability to actually participate, come back to the city. So You know, that means investing in the experience, making sure that we don't take anything for granted, you know, clean the streets out the front, and you know, just make sure for our part we do everything with 100% commitment again. And you know, it's often the way, isn't it? We are all rebuilding. The city is rebuilding. And I don't know, I had this thought go through my mind early in the early days of COVID, and thinking that this is 3 years of dealing with the immediate situation, but probably 7 years before we actually recover and we find what a, you know, our way out the other side, where COVID stops becoming part of the conversation and we're looking optimistically to a new, you know, humanity is moves on quite quickly, but it just feels like it's going to take us 7 years to go through the cycle.
Yeah, I think time has to be our friend in this, and a bit of patience. But I love what you just said then, that attitude of, you know, make it confident, make people feel welcome and make it desirable. And I can see that as an individual or as an organisation or as a venue, that's exactly what Mariner Theatres are doing. So that's sort of your part in making Melbourne, you know, a place to visit again. So, yeah, congratulations on your contribution to it, because it's going to be a big team effort.
Yeah, thank you. I think the other thing that is changing in Melbourne is we've got this connection to the city just through the geography, that, you know, it's sometimes referred to as, you know, the spokes on a wheel. Like, you can branch out from the CBD and 360 degrees, but ultimately everything converges within the CBD. And I think the opening of the metro train loop or tunnel, which will be that direct route through the southeastern suburbs, and, you know, really like almost like hotel type platforms and arrivals, I think will change the way that people feel too about moving in and out of the city. For example, we, you know, we live 10 kilometres out of the city, and it'll be an 11-minute train trip to the doorstep of the Regent with the town hall station. So I think the logistics of getting to and from the city will be really appreciated in the near future too.
It's just going to get better and better. And it's the same, you know, the CBD is one bit, then there's what people call the arts precinct, and of course we've got our sporting precinct, which is really not far from the CBD either. I mean, the geography, just, it's so critical to the event status of what goes on down in Melbourne. And yeah, it's key to that whole kind of event going success story.
Yeah, it's all concentrated. And you know, I always add into that too the botanical gardens and the Yarra River. And you know what, you don't have to travel far, or you travel in and you've got kind of got everything in Melbourne. So I think the future's bright, but obviously we're coming back from a real nadir in the history of Melbourne, given that for the last 2 years, really, people just withdrew from the CBD.
Yeah. Oh, look, today has just been an incredible kind of history lesson of theatre, and it's been really nice to celebrate our industry with your stories. We do like to ask a couple of more questions before you go. And you have actually talked a little bit about this, but one of them is, we like to start with, why does arts matter? We've had some really interesting answers and really philosophical answers to this one. But, yeah, why does arts matter to you?
Arts for me matters because I believe it represents one of the highest attainments in humanity. It celebrates the very best of who we are as humans when we can use the arts as a means of expressing the human condition. And I think that is, as I said before, it's not my talent, but I truly appreciate and celebrate what art, be it music, performing arts, theatre, fashion, music represents in all of our lives. And I think and our life is enriched significantly by having an appreciation and involvement in artistic practice, either as a practitioner or just as an audience or somebody who appreciates that talent.
Yeah, that's a lovely answer. Thank you. Now, the next one, I think you've probably answered it. It was going to be, where did you discover your love of theatre or entertainment? But maybe I'll rephrase it and say, have you passed on your love of theatre and entertainment to your family and your children?
Yes, unquestionably, they all love it. And, you know, isn't it an amazing opportunity? And I think it's the case almost universally that everybody whom is blessed with the opportunity to attend an arts event, musical, theatre, rock band, gallery, when they're young, I think it informs the rest of their life, whether or not directly or indirectly. So, yeah, it goes without saying that all of my four children, as much as they love their footy and cricket and golf you know, the more camping and outdoor activities, they absolutely love the theatre as well.
Yeah, everyone when we have this chat talks about a really fond childhood memory, whether they were performers or they were taken or some sort of very memorable experience, and it does set them up for a lifelong love of theatre and the arts. So, yeah, take your kids to the theatre. It's really important.
And, Lyndall, can I ask myself a Dorothy Dixer here?
Yeah.
If you were going to do one more, if you were going to do one thing for the arts, what would that be? Or what would be one big idea looking to the future? And I think, wouldn't it be an amazing experience if the opportunity to participate in, let's, in our case, a musical theatre, wasn't limited to parents or schools or parents directly, that it was actually more embedded into everyone's education, so that once, maybe twice times throughout an educational career, that you got the opportunity to experience first class performing arts event. And you might decide that it's not your thing. You might become a lifelong supporter, and or it might become your vocation, but at least you've had that opportunity. And I still think in this day and age, when we have so much, that the arts are not as available to everybody is a bit of an issue. And I'd love that to be, and I don't actually think it would cost that much money at all. It's just the endeavor.
Yeah, it's like the arts needs their version of Auskick or Aussie Hoops, you know, that we're getting kids in to come and experience it. It's low cost and it's accessible, but they still get to have the whole, yeah, exposure and experience. And it shouldn't be limited by socioeconomic situation or geography, or it shouldn't be limited by anything.
No, I think, and, you know, if you just use some simple metrics, and, you know, we've sort of thought about this, if in Victoria there's 200,000 kids in 3 year levels, and if the subsidy on every ticket was $50, that's $10 million, which in an arts budget is very little.
Mm.
And that would, you know, if it was a $100 ticket, a $50 ticket moves into a excursion levy type area. But even then, having a philanthropic ability to mitigate the travel and ticket price completely, it's also too not, in the scheme of things, a big ask. And I just think, that's the one thing you'd love to make it. You'd love everybody to have had that experience and to inform the way that they interact in the future, just not because they haven't been exposed.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there's a call to arms to our governments and some of our corporates to look at audience development with the Mariner Theatre Group and see what you can come up with.
Yeah, well, we are very much, as you know, from come from away, we had nearly 10,000 kids, 7,000 before we, and that was really quite extraordinary. And we were using that as a little bit of a, you know, case study. Obviously, the intervening 2 years has meant we probably have to reboot. But, you know, again, Come From Away was just such an extraordinary production for kids, because it's amazing that 9/11 was not something that is in a, even though it changed the world so dramatically, the tone and temperament, kids that are now at high school weren't alive then.
Yeah, so they don't know really enough about it. Yeah. Well, on that note, talking about audience development, I think that is where the future of our theatres are, aren't they, trying to get more young people in to experience it. So we might leave it there, but it has just been an absolute pleasure chatting with you today, Jason. And, yeah, I feel really inspired and excited about what the future of theatre holds for us, particularly in Melbourne. I know it's in really capable hands. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Lyndall. Thank you for the invitation, and it's been great.